Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. It's nice to be here. And, you know, I have to tell you, I really enjoy the studio. There's something about the headphones, the microphones, yeah, and this office that has more stuff in it than any room this size could possibly hold.
Yes.
It is quite warming. And I'd like to give a big welcome to all our listeners to the next chapter with Charlie. This week, I intend to cover the topic of core beliefs and how they evolve over a lifetime. For example, when a person begins skiing, imagine when a person begins skiing at any age, the slope provides a grand masterpiece to be explored and experimented with. You can go anywhere you want. But after a time, we find our paths and our routes that we most enjoy, and so we begin to use them more often. And before long, our skiing experience begins to be limited to the grooves of the path that we have laid, and soon that path becomes a rut, which is difficult to alter. Now take that example and consider that I have discovered over the years that we have lived more ruts that we have developed in which there is often little room for creativity and change. As a result, our lives are certainly comfortable and predictable, but there are also resides deep within us some little imp, I know I've got one, pleading for change in new ways. Some people hear that voice and some don't. I'm speaking today for the people who hear that voice and those that are wondering what that voice may be. You know, I have read that retired people are attracted to travel as a means of learning new way of life and seeing people in other culture. They have figured that they've seen what they've seen and learned what they've seen in the States, and that people want to go out and try other things. And their comfort zone is no longer quite as necessary, and it may not even be quite as comfortable. Many of us long for, I know I do, long for something new and something exciting. I remember when I graduated seminary, I graduated a very conservative seminary, and my advisor for the seminary, you know, when I left seminary and I graduated and I left and I asked him for advice, he said, "One thing I want to warn you of, Charlie, is that you have a proclivity for the novel." I have always...
Wow, that's a way to put it.
Yeah, I love that. And he says, so you need to find a conservative wife who's going to keep you on. And what I've done is ruined her. So, but my question is, Paul, why wait for retirement? What if we were to attempt to broaden the scopes of our lives to include adventuring into areas that might have been once unacceptable or even taboo? I'm into taboo. What if we were to experiment with other belief systems, other cultural styles of life, new activities, and a generally open mind to accept beliefs and ways of life that challenge our personal status quo? So that brings me to today's topic, and that is pulling out of mental ruts. So let's begin our conversation here. And Paul, I'm going to invite you to jump in anytime you feel you want to.
So mental rut. So we spend our whole life.
You jumped in quickly.
Blazing a path, finding a way to go, and you want me then to jump out of that comfortable path that I had to carve out of the snow here.
Yes. And what is your feeling to that?
I would say it kind of what we were talking about the week before. I think there are two schools of thought. One is you spend your whole life trying to find what's comfortable and then hold on to it, which a lot of people do. And, of course, that's hard to do. Life changes. But you got the old hippie in you here, which I do too, of what's over the next mountain. Okay, what else you got? And that's you take that for granted. I don't think a lot of people think that way. They find that frightening. They find ruts comfortable.
I agree. I think that is one of the things that I talked about is earlier, is that it is very comfortable. And it's And it's quite disturbing to go out of that comfort zone.
Yeah.
Quite frightening to go out of that comfort zone. And yet, when you experiment with small changes to that and find something new and something different, then, you know, it was well worth it.
Can I give you a dramatic example? When my mother had Parkinson's disease,
yeah,
at the end. And so my dad, they lived back in the Midwest in a beautiful home. They spent their whole life saving and loved everything about it. But the neighbors died, the neighborhood changed, and the house that they loved became a burden. So my dad is trying to take care of her in this big house. I said, come on out to California. Let's take you someplace. Let's find you a smaller place that you can retire in. And he was all for it. He was more like you. You know, this ain't working. Let's try something new. And my mother fought. She'd been in the house for 40 years. I can't get rid of this lamp. I can't get rid of that chair. My stuff, my things, my comfort zone. And she fought and kicked and screamed, but in the end she had to come because he was coming and he was her only caregiver. And my mother, when I flew back there, they sold everything they owned, every stick of furniture, except their bed. One piece they bought when they were newlywed and the last thing he held on to. And she looked like somebody had stolen her dog.
Really?
She just looked so sad and so upset and so like, this is the end.
No kidding. Was it soon?
No, she lived, actually, then she came out to California, and I thought, she won't last. She's just going to decline mentally and slip away. And she found another 10 years of life because suddenly she discovered, we got a new house. We're newlyweds again. We can, new friends, new house, new life, new furniture. And that brought, I've never forgotten that analogy because giving up was the hardest thing for her to do. But once she did, once she gave up that rut, that 40-year rut, it was exhilarating, but you would have thought it was the end of her life when she did it. Why is that?
You know what I think it is? I think it's fear.
Well, clearly it's fear.
You know, and I think it's fear that anything that I've often said, a bad known is better than any unknown.
Yes, well, it certainly wasn't her case.
Because it's predictable.
Certainly wasn't her case. So as bad as things had gotten, as difficult it was for them to hold on to the house and live there, do all the things you have to do, big house, big chores. You know, my dad was up in age, couldn't handle it anymore. She couldn't handle it anymore. They couldn't enjoy it anymore. What once was a joy had become a burden, but they couldn't let go of it easily.
Yeah, and what I'm suggesting is not that people make radical changes in their life, not that they do. They sell everything they own, and I'm suggesting you try some new things.
Right.
I'm suggesting you get out of that, I'm doing the same thing every week, and I watch the same television shows every night, and I come home and have my dinner and watch my TV shows and go to bed and get up and go to work, and then on Saturdays I putz around the house. I think that's all fine. I think that's wonderful. But there are some adventurous, wonderful things that you could add to that is really not cost prohibitive.
So what are the good routines and what are the bad routines? What are the good ruts and the bad routines? You brush your teeth every day. Is that a good rut? That's
a
routine.
If you want to keep them.
Yeah, right. So we have certain things we've trained ourselves to do. You could call it a rut or I could call it a routine. We find comfort in those. We find security in those. But at the same time, you're saying if you don't get out of that and challenge yourself once in a while, you miss something else. You're just painting
in black
and white.
Yeah, well, I didn't have brushing your teeth in mind. But
yeah, well, that's a silly rut. But I don't know about you. You talk about, for example, people always ask, I love going out to dinner. People always say, what's your favorite restaurant? And I kiddingly say, it's the one I haven't been to yet. I love exploring new restaurants. Most of my friends hate exploring a new restaurant because they don't know what they're going to get. I could get a bad meal. I said, but you could get a good meal. You know, or you could get a bad meal. That's just the risk you take. It's unknown. Isn't that fun? No, that's bad. So it depends on how you view life.
I wonder if it does have to do with what Dina talked about in archetypes. And people have different archetypes.
Maybe.
And people are comfortable with different things. And so I am I'm going to challenge people with the comfortable archetype of staying in a comfort zone and challenge them to step out gently. After our last podcast, I found our last session very interesting, in which we observed that many, many people don't even care about what was once considered core beliefs regarding religion and politics.
Yeah,
I'm just taking those two subjects. There were other things that were
involved. Yes, right.
And, you know, Paul, I was wondering how this even came about. And I wonder, maybe this has been around for a while, but it's coming to the forefront more now than it did before. And I wonder about the impacts of our recent election, in which at least half the country is dissatisfied with politics, and in religion as a result of the deaths that's coming from the radical Islamists, and many people have turned away from all religion in frustration of it in general, that there is something with general. And I'm wondering if those two specific events have really turned us to apathy. I don't even want to be a part of this. If this is a result, I don't even want to be a part. Do you think they've played a role, or just?
I'm a good Irishman. I can be pessimistic as anybody here, and look at the glasses half empty instead of half full. And I have a tendency. It is kind of a fear of mine, as I expressed on that show. I think we've lost our belief in beliefs. We haven't just lost our belief in people, cops, priests, politicians, whoever else we used to look up to and admire, athletes. But I think we have, because I think we've been disappointed by so many of them, but I think we've at some point lost either faith and belief, or we've been overwhelmed by choices. Our generation was about choice. We felt no choice. You were going to do what your father did. You were going to live down the street. You were going to follow. You were going to, if he was a Republican, you're a Republican. If he was a Democrat, you're a Democrat. I think we were all about breaking barriers and finding ourselves and trying everything. And I think that's almost played out. I think it's gotten to exhaustion. Some people are saying, I don't need that. That's too disconcerting. It's too chaotic. It's not sure enough. Or they're just overwhelmed by the choices and the fights, and they're just say the heck with it all.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not talking about that we have to take up travel and that we have to take up completely new lifestyles.
Painting. You took up painting.
I took up painting, and you know, which I'm really not painting a lot right now. I don't have the compulsion to paint, but I think about a painting every now and then. But I'm just talking about ways of thinking, ideas. You know, am I willing to challenge my own ideas? For instance, after our last podcast, what I wanted to talk about, though, as this form of non-thinking about deeper meaning of life become a mental rut with a frustrated population. And I think that is part of the big issue, is a frustrated population.
People don't think they can change. It hasn't worked. They're just tired of the argument and the thing. So as we become more polarized, as the tribes become entrenched, and we turn into polar opposites, there is some group of people in the middle that say a pox on both parties. We certainly see it. We talked about elections, the growing number of people who say decline to state, don't want to pick a party. The growing number of people that don't affiliate with any church, just not even going to go to one anymore. The growing group of people that don't follow any ism. And so, therefore, we're suddenly, as solidified as the two sides have become, they're driving a lot of other people to say the heck with the whole thing.
You know, the whole organizational process is in flux. Remember,
yes,
several weeks ago we had an interview with Sherry Benjamins, and it was talking about the workforce, and the workforce is moving from employees to contractors.
Yeah. Wow, and there's a big change, right?
And that the whole infrastructure of the corporation is in the midst of a flux right now because of the new population that doesn't want to be involved in this organization, bureaucratic stuff that gets in the way of them, what they feel is producing and doing a good job for the company.
And that redefines our relationship with the corporate, but, you know, corporate means corpus, body. It's a body of people. Maybe you're not part of a body anymore. You're just a symbiotic animal.
No, you're part of a body, but it's a smaller body.
Yeah.
It's a group. They work in groups. They're really... And they may not be always in the same location. They may be in remote locations.
I'll give you another fascinating one.
They are working in groups.
I'll challenge you with this one. This was on another one of our shows.
Well, I love a challenge.
Somebody came up and they said the millennials, you know, we all talk about how the millennials are different and they want meaning. They don't want just meaningless work, like we were rote work that so many of us were willing to accept. They want to see some purpose and meaning. Okay. And this person's challenged everybody and said, you know, for the first time ever, when you, if you're a millennial and you go to work, you don't need the boss to tell you what to do. You can go Google it. Go look it up on YouTube.
Or like Sherry said, you can call your friends.
Call your friends.
And ask your expert friends how to do it.
So all of a sudden, they don't have the inherent respect or the inherent reluctance to challenge power because, well, they know how to do this. I don't. No. I know as much as you do. If I'm going to learn from you, it's not how to do it. It might be something more nuanced. It might be something... You might give me the opportunity to do it. You might give me some guidance. You might give me some wisdom of what you've observed. But the basic functions, I can go learn on my own.
Yeah, and that's that is in itself non-rut thinking.
Yeah,
that is thinking. Okay, what can I do to do this best? And what can I'm not going to just follow a program. I'm not going to follow the way that it's always been done.
Certainly doesn't create many sheep, though. Where society needs some sheep to follow, and we're suddenly turning everybody into their own thought machine, their own expert.
Oh man, you know, Paul, how many times have I said, you know, and I make it 2025. I'm really going soon that we won't even recognize where we're. What the workforce looks like.
You say that. I think it's true. I thought you were kind of exaggerating at first, but I think things are changing so rapidly. Just our relationship to the whole, to the body, our blind acceptance of beliefs and isms without challenging them, our instant respect for age and authority. Yeah, what do you got that I can't figure out myself? What else you got? Just because you did it for 20 years and you're older, I don't automatically accept that.
Yeah,
I have to listen to you.
Those are great ideas. Let's move on. You know, I had another question I wanted to throw out, another comment and a question.
And all right.
The three podcasts that preceded our apathy podcast last week.
Mm-hmm. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The trinity of a religious discussion.
Well, I don't know if it was Father. It may have been a trinity, but it wasn't the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But what we did was, for those first time hearing this, we did three different means of understanding the nature of God or no God, and we began with the exploration of atheism with Matthew Sitton, then went to theism with an Episcopal priest, Father Robert Edwards, and as if those two weren't controversial enough,
yeah.
We concluded with Dan and his exploration of a spiritual life by means of the hallucinogen ayahuasca.
Yeah, right.
Which
searching for this Indian, what do you call it? What did he call it? The mother spirit or friend?
Yeah. I think he called her grandmother.
Grandmother, yes, right.
Yes.
The sort of Indian approach, sort of like a native Indian, American Indian approach.
Amazonian.
Amazonian, okay. So this notion of a spiritual, and your spiritual animal and your guide and all this other. Is there some
but
other?
Now, with this, each of those gentlemen was firmly entrenched in his belief system.
Yes, they all were passionate about a belief, their belief.
But I personally got the impression that each was also open-minded enough to accept a different belief if the evidence were convincing.
Yes, because we're all of a certain age and we still believe in evidence.
Well, this, you know, Michael was young. You know, Michael's 25, 26 years old. But
in today's age, evidence is under attack. Facts are phony.
Well,
facts are fake.
Yeah, we can.
Experts are.
I guess there's
a certain knee-jerk reaction to people. If you say an expert told me this, people say, "Yeah, so what? I'm an expert."
Yeah, we owe that to the election.
And I think in the internet, this idea that. You know, there's no filter anymore, so you can say whatever you want, and you can choose to believe it if you want, and you can search for anything. Facts aren't as black and white. We don't have any, we use a baseball analogy, there's no umpires calling balls and strikes anymore. Oh, that one's fake, that one's false, that one's true. There's nobody, it's just everybody out swinging.
Back on our three men that we spoke with,
mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we spoke with three very thoughtful men. But the show with the most comments to me was the one on hallucinogens. And they weren't always positive comments. He says, these guys are just looking for a way to get high. And they're calling it a mystical experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Tim Leary did that. Well, you know, that was 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, but some did confirm the potential of a new psychological approach to mediate mental health, which really has been stuck on prescribing daily medications that have had moderate success at best. You know, the medications that cure depressions and anxieties. And
post-traumatic stress. Yeah.
PTSD, you know, have had really just a modicum of success. And I am much less concerned with mental health, albeit traditional or non-traditional. I'm more concerned about our willingness to learn and to challenge even our most deeply held beliefs. That's what I wanted. That's the show we... Coming down, that's the show that was in my heart today.
Let me ask you, before you get there, I have a question that just popped into my head here. When I was raising a daughter, and you raised a son, we came from the era where, tell me anything. Nothing shocks me. I've tried it all. I've done it all. Oh, so you did this, you did that drug, you tried this thing, you went off and crazy. Great. You know, most of us are the child of the 60s. But what's the one thing, for me, there was one thing, though, that I saw evident in my daughter's era that did shock me, and that was violence. This proclivity, again, to, you know, well, he hit me, so I got to hit him back, you know, disrespected me. This sort of gang-like culture that permeates from all the way from top to bottom here. That scared me, and I think we're seeing it again in school violence and everything else. That's one that I can't just go, oh, okay, so you experimented with guns or whatever. That's one that scares me. That go way off in the direction there? So I'm just saying, is there any experiment that would shock you? Is there anyone that you'd say, no, that's too far. Don't try that.
I'm sure, but but I can't think of one offhand.
Yeah, because you're open to try everything. But there must be some, are there some safe ruts that we shouldn't veer out of? Are there some core?
Oh, of course. Of course. I think tradition and ritual is very important.
Yeah.
I have my morning ritual that I, for 2 years, did not stray one morning, and then for about 4 months strayed, and I felt the difference, and I'm back into it for the last week.
There you go.
And back into it said, you know, and it has to do with my meditation and my reading and my journaling.
Right.
The things that I do in the mornings before to get my day started. I somehow started reading email to start the morning, and that just screwed the whole day.
So there is some purpose to, and I'm a good Irish Catholic, so I believe in the traditions of the faith and whatnot. There is some comfort in tradition. There is some comfort in, you could call it a rut, but it's following what came before, the path laid before. It's just a question. So when do you know when to stay in the rut and when to veer out of the rut? When should you be venturesome and when should you be right down the middle? How do you know when?
I don't think I should ever be straight down the middle. I think I should always be experimenting and always trying something new.
So I think of the people who came across the country who followed the Oregon Trail and all these paths that were somehow laid out. And I don't know if you've ever, I've taken trips on the Oregon Trail, and there are points along the way that they stopped and everybody.
Yeah, I wouldn't call that a rut. I would call that, you know, that's quite different.
Following a proven path.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that metaphor is really extreme because, you're going over the Rockies and you're, you know, there's a certain way to go and there's a certain way to die.
Yeah, so you can find water, right?
Yeah, and I'm not talking life or death.
Okay.
I'm talking belief systems, core values, and core activities. Are you willing to step out of your comfort zone and experiment with some of these? I believe, as I wanted to talk about a bit more, but I'm not going to get into it a lot, I believe that we are all cursed with a medical phrase called scotoma. But it is rendered metaphorically as selective blindness. Scotoma is we actually do have a blindness in our eye. and we are, I can't explain it medically, but there are blindnesses that our brain makes up for and makes everything perfectly clear, but that we do have physical blindnesses. Scotoma, though, metaphorically, is selective blindness, and we have blind spots to truths that fit our deeply seated belief system. And any attempt to dissuade us from that position is often comprehended as...
threat.
Exactly. A personal assault. My question is, what are we afraid of?
You know, this is the times we live in. You know, again, are we open or are we frozen? Are we fixed in our views and afraid to try something different? Or are we open to trying new ideas and to testing things? Are we open to talk to each other?
Those are good questions, but it doesn't come to what are we afraid of if somebody differs in belief from me? I know, because I know what it does is it goes to the core person. They are not rejecting my idea. They're rejecting me as a person.
Right.
So we're going to some very deep psychological issues of identity, ego, self-esteem, those sorts of ideals are challenged when somebody challenges my thought. And that doesn't necessarily, that shouldn't be.
But look what happens when somebody's belief system is shattered. Wars or other sorts of things have been books and written about. What happens when, you know, after the Civil War, after any war, whatever, your belief system is just shattered if you're on the losing side. How do people handle that? The lost generation between World War I and World War II, people, the writers and the Hemingways and the Fitzgeralds and all those people went to France and just really couldn't find anything positive out of World War I and the whole meaning and experiment. Just they call themselves the lost generation. They lost a lot of belief in anything.
I think that was probably healthy because the beliefs that they had before didn't work.
No, led to
obviously
a massive
they
world
didn't
war.
Work. So now it's time to, you know, move on to a new belief system, which Sartre brought us into, as we talked about nihilism last week.
Yeah,
you know, brought us into
right.
an existentialism, brought us into a whole different idea. I am just wondering why my feathers rise up when someone disagrees with me.
I think it's who you are. This may be a really silly, again, maybe I'm way off base here, but you know, I grew up in a car culture. Boy, somebody challenged your car when I was a kid, you're ready to go and fight about it. Because it wasn't just your car, it was who you were. It was my identity. That's me. And if you laugh at that car, you're laughing at me. I think we get wrapped up in these belief systems. That's how we define it. It's like your team. You know, if you attack my team, I attack your team back here. That's why we belong to tribes. That's why we follow teams. That's why we have belief systems. Somehow that defines us and gives us something solid to hold on to. If we don't have that, then we're lost. We're wandering in the desert. We're unsure.
And if we do have it, we have a rut.
Yeah, right.
That is unwilling to talk to other people, to make a decision such as Matthew Sitton did. You know, he made a decision to move from a devoutly faith-based family orientation to a totally non-faith-based family decision. But he was willing to challenge his belief system.
And is that something you only do once in life? Is there a point when you have to decide, who am I? Which way am I going to go? Am I going to go left? Am I going to go right? Am I going to follow my parents' path? Or am I going to forge my own? It seems like there's a point or two in your life when you do that, but you don't do that all the time. Would Matthew Sitton come back in 10 years and say, you know, somebody challenged me again, and now I do believe in God again?
Yeah, he could. And my question is, and? So?
Charlie!
He changed his mind.
Do we like that?
Yes,
that a good idea?
Absolutely. We need to be, you know, Tim Ferriss, you know, my podcast hero.
Right.
I think I said this once before in a podcast that he has this question he asks at the end. If you could place a billboard any place in the world that you wanted, or any place in the United States that you wanted it, what words would you put on it? Mm-hmm. And mine are very clear to me. It's change your mind. You know, whatever you think.
But would you change your mind about doing that at the last minute and change the words?
I could. Yeah. Very, very definitely. I could. But I think, you know, I think we're facing something even different than, and it's something we talked about last week, even different than in the rut, than I'm going down this road, I'm comfortable. But it's also, it becomes where I'm not just comfortable, but it becomes controlling.
Well, clearly.
This is it. This is what I have to do. I have to get up in the morning. I have to make the breakfast. I have to take the kids to school. I have to do blah, blah, blah. And you get this ongoing every day is exactly the same.
And it can be destructive. I'll give you another weird analogy since we're talking about it. I'm trying to put all these pioneer images in here. The word stump. Do you know where the word stumped comes from? In the old days, they would cut down trees to make a road, right? But they didn't pull the stump out, so they would just cut it really low, and the wagons would roll over the stump. But as the wagons went through the same rut and dug deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, that stump got higher and higher to the point where suddenly the ruts were so deep that the cart would get stuck on the stump. So we followed this path until it stopped us, until it became bad.
Well, you just gave a metaphor for my whole position.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you're sorry. You want to take that. Now you want to take that back.
I don't take that back.
Can I take that back? And I think it's a great metaphor. And I think that is a great metaphor for what happens in ruts. Is that there gets a block in the rut, and then what do? We have to change our mind. We have to change our ways. We have to change
what we're
doing. Right. Like your mom had to change. But in the process of changing, she found something different. In the process of changing Hemingway and all who were writing after World War I, they did some of their best writing then.
Yes, exactly.
Because they were profoundly impacted. Now, whether it was positive or negative, they were profoundly impacted by that event, which was
the Great War.
the silliest war.
Oh, talk about stumbling into something and nobody wanted. Yeah,
yeah. But you know, today, as we talked, and I don't want to rehearse our last week's discussion, but today we're talking about something even worse than selective blindness, and that's apathy, and that's I just don't care, and that is concerning.
That scares me. There's another one along the line. When I was a kid, I was in college at the University of Michigan. I took a course just for laughs, for easy credits, where we went out to the children's prison, the juvenile prison, whatever it was really called, outside of town, and saw kids that were locked up for major crimes, rape, murder, and they're 12. They're 14, they're 16. They weren't old enough to be treated and as an adult, put in an adult prison, so it was a kid's prison. It's the final step on juvenile. If you failed there, they waived you and put you in with the regular prison population. And they said, as they prepared us to meet these kids and talk to them and try and mentor them and other things, said, here's the biggest problem is they don't care. Hey, buddy, we're going to lock you up. I don't care. We're going to kill you. We're going to execute you. I don't care. You know, they'd gotten to a point where there was nothing. You couldn't entice them or scare them because they just didn't care anymore. That was scary. I never thought when you lose that, when you just don't care, how do you change anybody if they don't really care anymore to even think about it?
Yeah,
talk about it?
I wonder about that because the people, you know, we were talking about it and you received that feedback. That was anecdotal feedback. Mm-hmm. I wonder in many of the millennials I talk to, they would absolutely disagree with I don't care.
Good, because too many of my millennials in my world circle.
Well, I mean, they may not care about church and politics, but they do care about life.
Yeah, and that's true.
And they do care about making a difference in the world. It's not just their personal life. It's not just ego-centered. That they're a generation that really does care about the world and what kind of impact the United States is making on the world and how can they impact that themselves.
But there's no question there are people on the fringes, and the fringes are growing, that either through poverty or despair or whatever, just to a certain degree have lost the ability to care about themselves, about the world, about anything. You know, they're just angry, they're mad, they're sad.
I wonder, is that any different, Paul? Really, I mean, if you look in the 60s, you know, we talk about the hippies, but the hippies were a small number of the college population.
True, absolutely.
That was a very small number of the population. And I wonder if there was any less apathy then than there is now about, you know, after they hit 30, 35, 40, that it just started sticking in and they got into that rut.
Mm-hmm.
And they started just thinking in that rut and just thinking right along the same way, and this is the way my life is going to be.
Clearly, there's an awful lot of people still, even after the Enlightenment of the 60s, there are people who just follow the rut and didn't always. I grew up in the Midwest. I used to say, you just defined to me the Midwest. It ain't too bad. It ain't too good. I'm just going to steady path, stay the course. That's the way most of my friends' lives were and relatives back there. There weren't real highs and there weren't real lows, so they kind of smoothed it out. It was an unadventuresome life for many.
And I am advocating an adventuresome life.
Right.
My website has In Search of Meaning, Adventure, and Awe. And I think that is what really drives us. And if we are in search of those three things, we will have a contented life when we find those. And what I want to do is, in wrapping up our discussion today on selective blindness, and as we retitled it right before the show, Pulling Out of Mental Ruts. I had
right.
to look it up. Pulling Out of Mental Ruts. I have, guess what? I have three suggestions
how
to do it.
You're usually reluctant to give a suggestion to her. You're like, go find, I'll challenge you. You're the Socratic method. I'm going to ask the questions and you figure out the answers.
Yeah. I am, but I have some ideas on this because I feel strongly about it, and because in my archetypes that are not rut archetypes, you know, I have explorer, romantic, creative. You know, and my advisor telling me I have a proclivity for the novel, so I'm into change. you know, if something is the same way too long, I'm going to change it. That's why I'm shocked.
Do you ever change just to change? I mean, do you ever?
Oh, yes.
I knew people
that
just got bored. Even the things were going good, they just wanted to shake it up just because they got bored with similarity.
I've had a couple of products that I developed for organizations that were training products,
mm-hmm.
and they sold like crazy. Everybody absolutely loved them. But once I found out they were a success, I did not have it within me to go out and sell it and do it. I wanted to create something new.
Oh, wow.
I needed to hire somebody. I'd probably be a lot wealthier right now had I stayed with any one of these three. There were just three or four of them, but they were pretty strong. So here are my three suggestions.
All right.
Number one, whenever you find yourself in that knee-jerk response to someone's ideas that are in conflict with your own, perhaps you could, and this is probably later in the evening or later, you won't do it right at that minute, ask yourself, why did I so strongly disagree with that person? Just ask that question. What button did they push? There's some button they pushed. Was my personal identity challenged? Is it a secondhand belief? Or the result of a first-hand experience? And I've talked about secondhand beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, secondhand beliefs are what other people tell you you believe, and you buy into that. Before you know it, you're entrenched in that, rather than thinking through what
every parent does. Oh, you don't like that. You're not going to do that. Oh, come on now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it is a secondhand belief, if it's a secondhand belief. Or are you in a selective blindness rut? And I find myself often doing thought experiments, and that's contemplating the other person's point of view as if I believed it myself.
Wow, that's a weird game. So if I say to you, atheism, you suddenly go, yeah, okay, I'm an atheist.
Well, you know what would be a fascinating discussion is... it wouldn't be something for a podcast, but Matthew and I take opposite positions. You defend theism, and I'll defend atheism.
You should have gone to law school. I did. That's what they have you do in law school all the time. You argue a position, and they just flip.
Yep.
So they teach you that because your role as a lawyer, they teach you is not to defend any position, but to defend your client's position, to fight for whoever side you're on the best you can. And somehow out of that process, truth will emerge if you both do your job well.
Yeah, so I'm not looking to win anything. I'm looking just to see if I can identify what's going on personally. My second principle is this.
Yes.
What if I changed my mind? What if the argument against what I believe turned out to be more logical than my own? Do I have the courage, if that came out, do I have the courage to dabble in that new way of thinking?
Pretty scary. All of a sudden you're going to just change your mind, a long-held belief, and dabble in something else?
You know what I want to do? I want to give an example.
Okay.
We've got about 5 minutes
yeah.
here. I want to give an example. And that was when I was in seminary, which I fondly call cemetery.
I never heard you say that. Okay.
I was in a very conservative seminary. Matter of fact, it had the word conservative on it.
It was lest there be any doubt, we're going to tell
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it was.
If you couldn't figure it out already.
I love the seminary. I learned so much from the seminary. It was a wonderful seminary. It was called Western Conservative Baptist, and I'm thinking, like, duh. Why do you put conservative in it? You know, it's going to be Western Liberal Baptist.
Yeah, right. You know, Western Radical Baptist, yeah.
Yeah, but and I'm just going to give one example. And there was a great debate at my seminary, as you can imagine, evangelical Christianity, about pro-choice and pro-life.
Yeah,
and they were absolutely pro-choice, and that is where I stood for the longest time.
They were pro-choice or pro-life?
Did I say pro-choice?
You said pro-choice.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Right?
No.
Pro-life.
They were pro-life. And I held that position for a while, but I held it loosely, and I held it softly and kindly and lovingly and tenderly. And then I discovered something. Until I can put a face on my religious principle, it is most often misdirected. Mm-hmm. So I had to know a person who was pregnant. It had to be a person, and I had to... Now I'm considering not a principle of pro-life or pro-choice. I'm considering a person.
Boy, that's powerful. Because in theory, you can believe anything. But when you know somebody who's gay or somebody who's going through trouble or trauma, yeah, can you still tell them?
That's the whole thing. You put a face on it. If sexual orientation bothers you, it means you don't have any homosexual friends.
Yeah, right.
And you don't know that they're just people, so with that little suggestion that you know that has made me, I'm not a Democrat, but I am a liberal in my religion, because once I put a face on it, I have a heart for these people, and I can go through all the logic of it, but that is in my argument. Until I can put a face on my position, either for or against something, it's really just an inane argument. We're
yeah.
arguing principles.
Right.
And who cares? And so the third thing that I want to suggest is, are you willing, here's the question, are you willing to sacrifice the safety and security of a sketchy belief system that you know you're not 100% sure you're in order to gain the fullness of life? Deselective blindness or getting out of the rut can put you in an insecure position, especially if you're not comfortable with change and perhaps the novel. But I find life works best when you are changing, when you are doing something different, when you are doing something new. I want to close with this, and I'm going to try to make this as brief as possible, although I want to go briefly through my work career, and really, Paul, I'll do it briefly.
Okay.
Is that I've had 5 to 7 different careers.
That in itself is amazing. That in itself is not. Although I think it's becoming more of the new normal than when you did it. There are more of you than there ever was.
But they're radically different. You know, some of these, they're not just kind of moving from, you know, a similar industry to another one.
Right.
I began at 15 years old, and I was working a real job. I had to lie about my age. I had to say that I was 16 years old because you can't.
You're not supposed to work at 15, right? Not, yeah. Not
and
child
I was working,
labor.
And I was working at a chemical factory in which I worked with men. I didn't, you know, I wasn't making shapes and flipping burgers. I was working with 30, 40, and 50-year-old men.
Pretty intense for a 15-year-old, yeah.
And I love telling the story. They used to give me the dirty jobs, you know, going to the acid tank and shovel out the acid tank
yeah.
where it's so hot. That so there's so much heat generated by the sulfuric acid that I'd have to fill up my water boots, my boots with water in order to stand into it and shovel stuff out. Well, you know, my mom washed my clothes that night and they all disappeared just because of the acid on my clothes.
Talk about acid washed jeans. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
And there were scars on my arms. And, you know, so that was, you know, that was just part of growing up. But I loaded trucks. I hand stacked soda pops, and you know, I worked blue collar jobs. But what that did, I ended up working with CEOs of billion-dollar companies as their personal coach. But what that did for me is that gave me insight into blue collar and high level white collar work, which I can get along with anybody. I can get in a group of
truck drivers,
Hispanic truck drivers, and right. you know, and when I was drinking, give me a Tecate, and, you know, hijola, man, what's going on? What is this chit? You know, and then I can also work with the CEO. But I had that job. I had a job where I managed 120 people in a carpet mill. And that was in my 20s.
Carpet mill, okay.
In a carpet mill. And then I made a change of life, and I became a minister. I went to seminary for 3 years. I was a minister for 7 years, and that didn't pan out because I was discovered I was not hardwired to be a minister. And then I became a trainer. Then I became a facilitator. Then I became a coach and a program director.
Yeah,
of which I developed, and all of these would be changes, and now I retired and died of boredom for 3 years, and now I have my web presence and my work with Wells of Life.
You're a podcaster.
Podcaster, and I'm deeply involved in Wells of Life. That is because I like change. I like to see life from a different perspective, and I'm not suggesting that everybody needs to lead a weird life like I do, but I am suggesting that if you're in a rut and you're moving forward, I like your metaphor, watch out for that stump.
Yeah, don't get stumped.
And then move on. So I think that's a great close.
Okay.
Don't
get stumped.
So I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. Also, be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life, L-I-F-E. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.